we are saying hello to my friend Frauke Musial. She has the wrong name in the picture, but her name is Frauke Musial from Tromsø. And your husband, right? Yeah. And Frauke is a biopsychologist. And before we are getting going and diving into tonight's topic, I will ask you, dear Frauke, to just introduce yourself a little bit and tell us, what is a biopsychologist? So what is your profession? It's a bit a strange word, right? So what is it?
It is, yes. And I understand that not everybody has an idea right away what this means. Mm-hmm. So in principle, it means that I'm a psychologist by training. And I have studied in Düsseldorf many, many years ago in the 80s. And at that point in time, Düsseldorf had a very special education, which was in part together with a medical student. And that was called biopsychology. Biopsychology is a subspecialty of psychology. And what we do is we look at behavior and then we try to find out what the physiological basis of that behavior is. And likewise, we look at physiology and maybe changes and processes in physiology and see how that affects behavior. So it is still a subspecialty of psychology. It has also components, and that's important when we talk about horses. It has also components of comparative psychology. And comparative psychology, comparative psychology is how different species have similarities and differences in their behavior and their the physiological basis of this behavior. So that's what I am by training. And but right now, I actually have a professorship in Tromsø of healthcare research alternative treatment. And the reason why that sounds a little bit strange, but many of these complementary therapies actually use intrinsic physiological mechanisms or psychophysiological mechanisms. And that's exactly where they wanted me as a biopsychologist. I have a strong background in pain research, but a little bit of a background in placebo. So that actually fits quite well. But I don't have that's often a misunderstanding. I don't have a professorship that deals with horses. That started as a hobby. So I was a good rider when I was young. So I grew up with horses. And then, I don't know, if anybody knows that, and it's not that important, but I have MS, multiple sclerosis, and I use a wheelchair. And during the course of my disease, that idea that I could try it just disappeared. And then I moved to Tromsø, and I had a colleague that was breeding Icelandic horses, and she put me on a horse. And ever since, I'm riding again. And I used to have, until the summer, two Icelandic horses. One died, unfortunately. Mm. So that's my story. And since I'm a scientist, that's my way to find out about things. So ever since, I, of course, have read everything there is to read about the biopsychology of horses and the behavior of horses and the physiological foundations, just because it's my special interest and my way to approach things. Super. And it happened then that I have started a blog, Science for Horse Lovers. And I ran very early into Selina, in fact. And that has actually fostered. So I think we started out together with a blog before my own blog. Because we started discussing, why is this so?
Yeah, that is true.
Why is it so? And that's dangerous to do that with me, because I may end up in an hour or longer class just teaching about why it is as it is.
Yeah, sometimes when we are having coffee together, I'm coming home and think I had a day at university or something.
I'm so sorry.
That's exactly what I need then. This is also the reason why I have invited you tonight, because I've been speaking a lot with my students also about how the equine brain is wired, how behavior is connected and stuff, and that many things have just to be seen. How do you say that in English? Art specific or specific to the species?
Species specific.
Mm-hmm. In German, we are saying art spezifisch. Sorry, but we took it tonight in English because we said, okay, then it's accessible for everyone, because I have so many students from all over the world, also. And Equidemia's mission, or also the mission of this podcast, is to always Yeah, we are taking up one myth at a time, and we have a look at it, and then we have a look at what science can tell us about one or the other thing, and cleaning that out and leaning or falling back onto the five domain model. And that's the reason why you are here today, because I have brought for you a few very specific questions, because a while ago when I was still young. And before I had my child, we took a couple of webinars together talking about the biopsychology of the horse. And there's a few sentences that I am remembering from that biopsychology course. And one of them was that, yeah, the equine brain is wired differently. I guess we will fall back on that later. And that the prefrontal cortex is different than in humans. And this is also why for tonight we have the topic of stress, fear, or trauma. What is it that we can talk about? I have a special case on my farm. I have a training horse on my farm that if I wouldn't have so many gray hairs, I would get them only for him. And Uni has developed pretty nicely the recent years since he is here. But once in a while, he is still giving me some thing to think about. So what we know about him is that he is the classical misunderstood horse, the problem horse, and he was sold from Portugal or Spain to Norway. I came to a really nice lady who has been trying her very best but wasn't prepared for the amount of trouble this horse has kept inside herself. And then she has been doing what every sensible horse owner is doing. She has been seeking for advice. So eventually she ended up with a horsemanship trainer where the horse made different experiences. And she also asked advice from veterinarians, but did not get the best advice. So eventually the horse came up here for training, and we have been continuing searching because his behavior was so exclusive, let's say it like this, exclusive. And what we found after a while, when he didn't want to get touched and didn't was just protecting his body, was several pain factors inside his body. And since we have been eliminating them, the horse is behaving differently, of course. So, but still, I took him out of the paddock. I wanted to do him a favor. One of my youngsters was mobbing him and didn't allow him to eat his minerals. I took him out and put him on the small paddock next to the riding arena. And then Uni was standing there eating. And I closed the paddock. And when I wanted to come back in, everything so far was normal. I wanted to come back in and had a rope in my hand. And I saw Uni looking at the rope. And then Uni changed his mindset completely. I couldn't touch him anymore. And he was just circling around me. So, Frauke, that was a crash course into Uni's story. Is that trauma, or what is that we are seeing here?
Yeah, that's a complex story, and I can only speculate. But have you seen that reaction to the rope before?
I have been seeing videos from him on Instagram where he has been showing this behavior, or I have been seeing the round pen work that was not very sensitive. And I have been, I had the trouble with him when I started longing him, that he was just mindless. He didn't stop running.
Yeah. Okay. That's not the first time you came in there with a rope. And I understand that as soon as you use a rope, he starts running, circling around you.
Yeah. And also when the space is limited.
Also,
you know, when the space is limited, usually when he's on the big field, he doesn't care. But now I put him into a small paddock. He couldn't escape. It was more a particular setup than what he's used to do. You know, my riding arena doesn't even have walls, so nothing has walls here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you use the rope and he can withdraw, it's not an issue. Mm-hmm. He stays voluntarily with mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, several things. First of all, the horse's brain is wired differently. Yes and no. So principally, and I really need to say that because I'm sometimes really surprised what I find out there about horses and how special they are.
And horses' brains, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So principally, mammals have the same brain structure. Or that's why they're mammals. And birds have the same brain structure. And I don't know, fish have the same brain structure. That's the category, right? So, but mammals have been extremely successful to conquer every type of habitat you find in this earth, right? But mammals have always the same things. They have one nose, they have a tail, they have four arms or foot, whatever you call it. They have two eyes, right? But if you look at all the mammals, for example, if you focus on the eye, a mole has almost no eyes. But it still has eyes, but almost no eyes. Mm. Yeah. But the horse has the biggest eyes of all land living animals. So why on earth, if you see all the variety, think of an elephant. Mm-hmm. A mole has a nose, a horse has a nose, and an elephant has a nose. So think about all the mammals. Just take a minute to think about what kind of mammals you know. And in what kind of varieties they come, and how perfectly they are adjusted to their environment.
To the niche, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, to the niche they are. So why would somebody on Earth think that their brains are alike?
Yeah.
But the brains have the same thing. They have a nose, they have eyes, they have a visual cortex, a visual part of the brain. They have an olfactory part of the brain. Mm-hmm. They have a motor part of the brain where all the motor, the limbs are represented. But how this occurs, how big it, the mole probably doesn't have a very strong, a very big part of the brain devoted to the eyes or to looking. It probably has a much bigger part of his brain devoted to smelling, to the sense of
what makes sense for him, right?
Yeah. So the thing is, brains have like mammals, as the mammal brain, like the mammal author appearance, has principally brain, the same structure, but how this is sort of developed, what is more developed, what is not more developed, is related to the niche that animal lives in. So yes and no. Principally, all mammals have the same brain structure. But how it appears may be very different according to the niche they live, because the niche will form their bodies and their senses, and their bodies and their senses will form how their brain looks like. Mm-hmm. So, which brings me to the discussion about the prefrontal cortex, because there's this huge discussion going on, do horses have a prefrontal cortex? And yes, I'm sure they have, even though nobody has shown that, but we know sheep has a prefrontal cortex, mice have a prefrontal cortex, rex has a prefrontal cortex. Cats have a prefrontal cortex. Even whales, everybody knows that whales can solve tasks that require a prefrontal cortex, but nobody could find it. For years and years, for decades, they have searched after the prefrontal cortex of whales. And there's just the publication out that showing where the prefrontal cortex of the whale is. It's sort of covered and hidden. Mm. So every single species that has been investigated, mammal species that has been investigated, has shown a prefrontal cortex. The thing is, primates and humans have an extremely large prefrontal cortex, but they are the exception to the rule. The thing is, when we come, if you guys think, wow, why is he talking about the prefrontal cortex? It is, in fact, important to understand fears and anxiety and how to overcome them. Because the prefrontal cortex is what makes you overcome fear. It is connected to a network that makes you overcome fear. And this is why humans can go to war. They have, the humans and primates are the exception to the rule because they have an extremely overdeveloped prefrontal cortex. And this is why they can, they can be intrigued, they can make schemes and plans and so on. So we have to keep that in mind, that not the horse is the one that's different. It's the primates and the humans that differ from the rest of the mammal realm in that they have this overdeveloped prefrontal cortex. It is helpful in many ways, but it is also a problem in many other ways.
In many ways, especially when you're thinking about the war technique.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But back to your horse.
No,
or
just
do you have a question to
when
me?
You no, just you have just said something that I think is very important, and therefore I would like to frame that a little bit and you know, underline it, and that is that humans are the exception to the rule.
Yes.
And I do believe that if we are understanding that, then we also start to become a little bit more careful with just interpreting from our human perspective behavior of different species.
Yes. I think the biggest pest in dealing with horses and horse training is anthropomorphism.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing. If you could just refrain from anthropomorphism, I think the world of most of the horses could be a bit better, of many horses.
A bit better, yeah. I agree.
So, okay, when that said, about your horse.
No, understanding stress, you said, is important, or understanding the prefrontal cortex is important for understanding stress and fear.
Okay, so if it's okay for you, I would make another loop and take a human example, not to be anthropomorphic. Yeah. When we talk about fears, we have a network, and that's also the same in all mammals. It has four structures. It has a hypothalamus, that is a region in the brain that is very much involved in hormonal secretion and regulation. We have the amygdala, which is the structure in the brain that sort of triggers the motor programs for the fight-flight response. So the amygdala is absolutely central in the fight-flight response, which is the stress response. And then there is a structure called hippocampus, that's important for memory. And then, of course, a structure called thalamus. And the thalamus is also called the gateway to consciousness, because every impression of our senses, like the visual sense, the hearing, all senses are rooted, with the exception of olfaction. Olfaction is a big exception. But everything else is rooted through the thalamus and then distributed. And when something, for example, we see a saber-toothed tiger, so the picture of the saber-toothed tiger goes through the thalamus and activates the amygdala because we have to run. And then the amygdala starts all kinds of programs that enable us to automatically run and not think. We don't think in that moment. We just run if we have this extreme stress response. And the memory structure of that will remind us, will save that experience for the next time. So the next time we see something, we run earlier. So this whole network, and then the hypothalamus provides us with the stress hormones. Now, to the humans. But humans are hunters, and they're social hunters. So our ancestors, when they hunted a mammoth, if they had had this unreflected fear response that is triggered through the amygdala, we would have not survived.
We would never have had dinner, at least.
No, and the world would probably be a much better place. But anyway, so humans can do something. They can overcome their fear. Mm-hmm. And that is this overdeveloped, monstrous prefrontal cortex. This really gigantic prefrontal cortex enables us to control our emotions, especially fear. Mm-hmm. So it's not that all the animals don't have it, but we as social hunters, it was necessary for us as a species to develop that to the largest extent possible. Mm-hmm. But there is something in humans that reminds us how it was before we had this big prefrontal cortex. And that is phobias. Have you ever?
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting because I've myself, and that's probably why I'm so interested in horses as a flight animal. I have myself worked on emotions and phobias, and we were using spider phobics as study participants, because spider phobics are wonderful. Spider phobics have no other problem; they just have this extreme fear of spiders. They're not distressed. They're not overly anxious. Some of them were really tough, but as soon as there was a spider in the room, they would just go bananas. And they had a hard time controlling it. And the thing is, I don't know whether you remember that old ad on some kind of cleaning detergent.
Yeah.
Where the lady would just stay beside herself and say, well, this doesn't look good. And that's sort of the thing with spider phobics. They stand beside themselves. They have this panic attack because of that little spider. And they tell themselves it's not dangerous and they can't control it.
Interesting. And, yeah.
Yeah. And we did studies on that. So what do you do with a spider phobic? I hope this is interesting enough for
absolutely.
People.
Absolutely. Go for okay. it.
So what we did, we looked at their brains. So we did an electroencephalogram. And we did evoke potentials, which means we can, when people see pictures, we can look at their brain response. And those responses can be different. They can be higher or lower or something like this. So, but we measure them. And if a stimulus is of special importance, then they can be quite big and extreme. And at the same time, we were looking at heart rate and all the cardiovascular variables and blood pressure. And also when you're anxious, you start sweating. So we were also measuring that. So these are variables that are connected to the autonomic nervous system, which is the nervous system that sort of mediates that stress response, also the relaxation response, both parts. So your muscles, as you get sweaty, your heart rate goes up, your blood is pumped out of your intestines into the musculature and so on and so on. And then we also looked at the brain in parallel. So what do you do with spirophobics? You do a therapy called systematic desensitization.
Desensitization. Mm-hmm.
So you work with a hierarchy of anxiety-inducing or fear-inducing stimuli, and then you walk yourself down. We actually had a tarantula at the department in Jena. And so the lowest stressor would be, I think, about a spider. And then the spider comes near and so on. So we would walk, we would first work on this hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Then we would teach them a relaxation technique. And then we would start with, and the most threatening stimulus was, in fact, not to put this big tarantula on your hands, because that's quite hairy. So that big tarantula actually was not the worst thing to do. It was like, I remember. But going into the basement and catch the spider of those fast-moving spiders, that was the worst. And we had this really nice basement with many, many spiders in the apartment.
That sounds pretty mean, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty mean. And they were really tough. So we did that actually in half a day. So we were starting with the lowest anxiety-inducing stimulus. And in the end, they were able to have this tarantula on their hands. And also to go into the basement and catch the spider. So the therapy was successful. And it was, I have to say, what I really liked in these studies is how these people were proud of themselves, because they didn't understand why they reacted that way. They were so proud, and many of them reported that it has changed their life.
Wow.
And I understand that, because it makes it, this is my biggest fear. But I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is great. That's really huge, right?
Yeah.
So I think I can't sit out in the garden and have a beer because I'm so afraid of spiders. Some of them really are there. But anyway, back to the study. So we had the stress response of the autonomic variables and we had this response in the brain. Mm-hmm. So we were measuring them before and after. And before, of course, we had this huge reaction. This heart rate was racing and the hands were sweating and we had this monstrous evoked potential in the brain. And also when you give them an array of flowers and then hide a spider, the visual attention would be whop. Nobody's as good as spotting a spider than a spider phobic.
Of course. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. You see them everywhere. Yeah. Mm.
Exactly. You see them everywhere. Nobody sees a spider, but they can tell you here are 5 spiders in the room. And you know what the funny thing is?
Mm.
They can still do it after therapy.
Interesting.
After therapy, though, that extreme stress response was gone.
Yeah.
But the special attention to identify a spider, to
was
have
still
this
there.
Huge was still there. But the stress response was gone.
Mm.
So their brain hadn't really, their brain had changed because it was not inducing the stress response, but the selective attention towards the spiders will never change in the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what I'm postulating now is horses are spider phobics. Or the spider phobia is
spider phobic.
Very good model for a horse.
Okay.
Because there's an old theory, Seligman was the researcher who said that humans are prone to develop phobias on certain stimuli, snakes, mm-hmm. heights, spiders. Mm-hmm. And he suggested a pathway from the thalamus directly through the fear network to the amygdala.
Okay.
And it is there. See, and what we do when we see a fear-evoking stimulus, we suppress that old pathway that connects the sensory impression or the picture, for example, of a fearful stimulus to the anxiety network. So we override this old pathway with our prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, and send the information first through the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, that's why our reaction times are much longer than the ones of horses. But in spider phobics, you can see when this override yeah. pathway, this younger pathway, evolutionary younger pathway, is out of function.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to understand the fear reaction of a horse, a spider phobic is not the bad. It's not a bad model. It's actually quite a good model. The only exception is that horses don't stand beside themselves well. That could have been a saber-toothed tiger, because those horses who did that are not alive anymore.
No, exactly.
But you know what the good thing is? We can treat that excessive stress response away with systematic desensitization. And
that's in horses.
That's exactly mm-hmm. what we do with horses when we train them. When we train them to be fear-resistant, we expose them to many, many stimulus, and systematically desensitize them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just not sure if you were ending with the sentence or if there was coming more.
I'm taking a break.
Yeah, I'm taking. Okay, take a break. Take a sip of water. Yeah, that of course, absolutely makes sense. Also, when we are seeing that in the relationship of that, horses first have to learn to be familiar with humans, and to interpret our intentions of for not getting scared basically each time you're lifting your arm, right?
You want me to comment on your horse?
Hmm?
You want to further exaggerate, or shall I go back to the case of your horse?
We can go a little further there. So we can go back to the case of my horse. And I just wanted to say that I also remember that we said horses have a nearly photographic memory. Humans don't. Right. And I guess that is sometimes also difficult. I also believe that many people don't really understand what trauma is in humans. So we just very quickly, we see a horse running and then we are quickly saying, yeah, this horse is traumatized. Or we see a big reaction from a horse and quickly say, this horse is traumatized, without even understanding what trauma is, and that it's sometimes difficult to just breathe it away. So therefore, I think it would make sense if we are spending a little bit more time on that and go back to that case.
Yeah, I'm sure your horse is not traumatized.
Yeah, I'm also pretty sure.
I'm sure your horse has a fear reaction to the rope that is possibly conditioned, because if a horse never has seen a rope, why should it be fearful? So it probably associates some negative, stressful experiences with the rope. But a really severely traumatized horse would be disresponsive. It would be shut down. And I've seen one time in my life such a horse, and it was just standing in the corner of its stall and would not react to anything anymore. And that has something to do with, and it's sort of it would be the equivalent, not to try to be too anthropomorphic here, but it would be the equivalent to a major depression. And the problem there is that there are basically two classes of stress hormones. One is the glucocorticoids, the cortisol, and one is the catecholamines. And the cortisol can actually can actually destroy areas in your brain. And so in very extreme situations, cortisol is secreted in very, very high doses. And that is usually the stress hormone that makes this reaction. So in this case, I would say a horse is traumatized. But it's not an on and off. You can have, of course, a horse with a very severe fear reaction due to maybe that horse has been in a car accident and is afraid of cars. Then, you know, depending how extreme it is, I would find the word trauma may be okay. I would also, but it's still, I mean, it's sort of a continuum, right? But the reaction that you described from your horse, I would not. I hear sometimes people, oh, he doesn't like the farrier. He has been traumatized.
By he has been traumatized.
I mean, that is not appropriate.
No.
If you have ever seen a really traumatized horse, you know that that is not appropriate, right?
Yeah.
And so I would like another example from the human realm, from clinical psychology, and that would be a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And in a post-traumatic stress disorder, something similar to the spider phobia happens just way more severe. Because what happens to these people is that they, when they have a stimulus, and that's what I said, the thalamus is really important because it connects stimulus, for example, a visual stimulus, to the fear reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And in these severe cases, stimuli that remind the person or that remind is wrong because it's actually not a controlled memory. It triggers the fear response without a memory and without that loop about the prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. And people feel this like they have been, for example, veterans, like they have been in that combat situation, they got traumatized again. It's real for them. But the thing is, we know a lot of studies about resilience against trauma. And we all and people are, when they're older, when they have more life experience, are less vulnerable to trauma. But we do know that from wars, from civil wars in particular, and actually from civilians, not so much from veterans, but we of course have learned a lot about veterans, mm-hmm. is that everybody gets severely traumatized. Everybody can get a post-traumatic stress disorder. It is just a matter of how many of these experiences they have. And that sort of brings me a little bit to the use of the word trauma in horses. I would say most fear responses that when people come to you as a trainer and say, yeah, my horse reacts so and so, are not trauma. But it is also, and a horse that's so shut down that, you know, you can't get contact to it anymore. It just doesn't react, not to other horses, not to you, not to anything. You can beat that horse up, it wouldn't react.
It wouldn't move, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. That is learned helplessness, and that's a severe form of trauma. So there's no doubt that that is a trauma. A horse that has just, like I said, maybe been in an accident, and if you can't desensitize it, it's probably a trauma. But it's a continuum, and I think I have heard the word trauma used so often for things that I think this is something that you can retrain. And as long as you can retrain it away, it's probably not a trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Thank you. That is one thing. And then I am so often standing there and then I'm looking at the horse, you know, and now I've been studying the recent years also because I had to quite a lot about pain and pain reactions. And yeah, not only the equine pain phase, but everything around discomfort in equines that I sometimes feel that trauma is used as an excuse. Or, you know, the horse is traumatized. It happened on its owner, with its owner before. It's 10 years ago, but it's still traumatized. And that's the reason why it still can't sleep. And that is, of course, that is for me as a trainer always a little bit difficult because I really truly believe that even if there was something in the past, we can't take that as an excuse for a bad today status.
No. And the thing is, I think this is really the topic trauma is too complex to use it as to just use it in all these situations, because a stress reaction or a fear reaction. That it usually goes together. So the physical reaction will be very similar if you have a stress reaction due to a physical issue, for example, pain. Or let's put it that way. It's like this worry cup model.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a sound and healthy horse and you train it and it's confronted with a scary situation, it will probably have a fear reaction. But it may not be exaggerated. And you will have it will be most easier to train this horse. Mm-hmm. If you compare it to a horse that already has a higher stress level, let's define a threshold where a horse would bolt.
Yeah.
Right? Let me find a threshold where the horse
will take our worry cup here, and then when the worry cup is full, the horse is starting
exactly.
bolting.
If it's half full, then it doesn't really take much for the horse to bolt. If it's empty, you actually have so much more to go for. And when I come back to the case of your horse, let's think you said you have discovered a pain issue after a while. That was him.
Yeah.
And that was quite complicated. Yeah.
Mm.
So let's think if you train this horse with a lot of pressure, which is stressful. It's a lot of, horses learn very well and they learn from pressure, but light pressure is usually enough. But some training methods use a huge amount of pressure based on a leader concept that's in my understanding. I mean, other people may think differently, and I'm not a horse trainer really, but I would say that they're misunderstood. So if you train a horse with a lot of pressure, it will probably learn very fast. But if that horse has an issue for a horse that's sound, it might be a half full World Cup. But for a horse that has a pain issue, and is stressed anyway.
Mm.
And then you put a training method that's very stressful on top. You might as well get an exaggerated fear response or stress response from that combination of an underlying issue and a training method that uses a lot of pressure. Right? And then, of course, you will get a conditioned response like you have seen. If that rope has been used for training, you say you have seen that in the video, you will get an exaggerated response because that horse was probably trained while in pain, already stressed with that method. Then the stress that was, even if your horse is sound now, that combined stressful situation is still in the horse's brain. It still remembers that exaggerated response. He doesn't remember. He doesn't have that overdeveloped prefrontal cortex and says, my pain issue is solved, so I shouldn't be as stressed. And in fact, pain patients don't do that either. Mm. The person that really struggles with constant pain will react to the slightest stimulus that reminds him that patient had it. Think about going to the dentist. It doesn't help if you say, well, you know, we use sedation and so on, and we use anesthesia, and you won't feel anything. You sit there sweating, having that response.
Oh,
and
that's
your poor horse in the round pen being reminded with the lead rope that something happened.
And also, we have to say that in situations like this, when we are using so much pressure, most likely the horse doesn't learn what to do. It learns what to avoid, right?
Yeah.
That's a very big difference. So it doesn't get strategies for solutions. It's just getting a strategy for avoiding more pressure.
Not necessarily. I think that depends on how you use it. Because in riding, whenever we use pressure and take it away, we would use the same method, but very, very mild. So the point is, when do you take it away? For example, if you think riding signals, what you would like to do is to use minimum pressure.
Mm.
But it would still be something called negative reinforcement. And that is you give a stimulus and take it away. But you would like to, and that is.
Yeah, but that's the point, right? You take it away.
You take
before
it away.
The horse gives
that's
up.
Exactly. And that is the point. First of all, you don't want to use a lot of pressure. You want to use just the right amount of pressure to evoke the response. and then go down with the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to start with the lowest amount of pressure, not with the highest amount of pressure. And in many of these dominance-based educational system, mm-hmm. training systems, the pressures I find they use to begin with are quite high. So you can use, so I when I try to explain that with negative reinforcement, mm-hmm. I say, you don't need to use a stimulus that's painful or noisy or loud or whatever. It is absolutely enough if you use a stimulus that's a little bit nagging. So if you take the pisk and make tap, 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 it's like a fly if you do it, but it's sort of nagging and you go away. And it would still be negative reinforcement when you stop it at the right time.
I would even say that I am working a lot with visual cues. So not even touching, but visual cues when we are thinking academic groundwork and stuff. So the whip is not necessarily touching the horse, or I'd not even take always the whip. Sometimes I just take my fingertip, turn my body and use my fingertip for strengthening, and still the horse is understanding it as negative reinforcement. Because even there, I'm just giving this visual cue, I'm building up a pressure with my presence, with my dominance, moving into the horse's eye, and releasing that pressure the moment I'm turning away. So even that is pressure.
Exactly. And that's the point. You have to release. And then it's a good training method because, first of all, you're very clear in your signal. And the other, it's a reward.
Yeah.
Except it's a reward. Negative reinforcement is a reward. It shouldn't be stress. But if your timing is bad, it can be extremely stressful. So that's sort of, first of all, if the dosage is really high, you don't need that in horses because they're so sensible. Then it is stressful.
Yeah, but humans are not.
But what did you say?
Humans are not so.
No, exactly. That's the point. I think horses must think we are so unpolite and just really not comfortable people. Yeah. So I think that's part of the issue here, which brings me to another point. And you mentioned the five domains model. And I think that is really, really important. We need to be sure that we have excluded everything. And from my own experience with my horses, I had a horse that I had been to the vet at least three times with the same issue. And they said, it's not there. So it's not always that you can be successful, but I think you should at least try to say, well, it has a past experience and it's fearful because of that. That's not enough. I think it's at least important to make an effort to exclude all health issues. And the thing is, and again, I would like to go back to humans and give an example. I used to work in gastroenterology, in fact, because I was interested in psychosomatics, which is sort of very related to biopsychology because diseases change the physiology and persons react towards it. So pain will change the personality. If you have chronic pain, it will change your personality. So that's why I was interested in that. And there's a syndrome called irritable bowel syndrome. And 20, 30 years ago, I was engaged in that topic. And the thing was that we were trying to find a definition that was not based on excluding everything else.
We have the same problem in horses. Yeah.
Exactly. Nowadays. That's exactly the same problem. We wanted to have a positive diagnosis that was not based on, well, you don't have anything, so you probably have irritable bowel syndrome, which is not good for a patient, really.
No.
And it has two sides on it. I have seen patients that got the diagnosis, irritable bowel syndrome. It turns out they had a colorectal cancer. Great. That wasn't good, right? But on the other hand, I've seen many, many desperate patients where the doctor said, we can't do anything for it. They were really suffering. And the doctor said, well, you know, I'm sorry. Probably psychosomatics is in your head.
Lovely.
And that's really bad.
Mm.
Meanwhile, we know there's a physiological basis, things have changed, and it's much easier now to give the diagnosis. But at that time, it was exactly that, to find that balance. But we should be careful not to label a horse with something like the irritable bowel syndrome because we don't have a better idea. So we have to exclude all, I mean,
all the other domains,
kind of trauma or whatever, we have to exclude, first of all, the physical things. We have to check that they're physically sound. And then, of course, when we look at their mental health, there may be a lot in there, in how the way they're housed, the way they're fed. So in general, animal or horse welfare issues that might cause the problem.
So also mobbing. Mobbing is a big problem in groups.
Yes, yeah. A disharmonic herd or group could be a real problem. So we also need to look at that.
Yeah, I agree. So if we are trying to wrap that a little, then the first thing I think that we need to understand is the brain is differently wired. The brain of humans and horses, though we have similar ingredients, compartments in there, it's still differently wired. So we can't compare reaction A to reaction B necessarily.
No, the thing is, I wouldn't say it's differently wired, but I would say with every development there comes, the problem with evolution is evolution does not forget.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution does not forget. It can only suppress and build over.
Yeah.
That's the point. So you are in fact right that we have the same brain structure, but they're differently developed and differently wired, because younger brain structure may have invented, evolution might have invented something new with a new brain structure. But the problem is the old structures are still there. That's what happens to the spiderphobic.
That's what happens to the spiderphobic, but not the other way around. So the horse can't just suddenly develop a,
No, exactly. And that's the point. I mean, we are able to conclude, for example, from an animal, from a cat or a rat, that's why we lose them in laboratory experiment, to humans, the basic function. But we cannot conclude from humans down.
Down.
That's not possible.
Yeah, I think that is a really important sentence. And I also know, I just encourage you guys who are listening, I see that we have quite a few listeners here. So that was point number one that we wanted to make clear. So we have a little different wiring there. So we can't, you said that very beautiful, we can't conclude from humans down. In this
exactly. Case. We can conclude from animals up to humans because the basic reactions are very similar, but we cannot conclude down. And the reason for that is in fact, this very developed prefrontal cortex. So what we can do some phytotherapy in Norwegian. We can talk to a patient. We can explain to a patient. A horse, we can't do that. But we still, for example, the training method, systematic desensitization. So many of the learning laws of learning apply to all animals, mm-hmm. in fact. So we can use that. But we cannot do, for example, a cognitive behavior therapy. We can do a behavior therapy with horses. We cannot do a cognitive behavior therapy because their brains are wired for a different purpose.
Yeah. Then we often see this overreactions in horses. And then you have explained very nicely, this is not a traumatized horse. A traumatized horse is a horse that is completely shut down and that doesn't react to any stimulus anymore.
I would say there it is clear that is a traumatized horse because it would be similar to a major depression. But I think there's an in-between thing. For example, if a horse had been in a car accident and had developed a fear of cars, I'm not sure whether that would be possible to treat that away or would take a long time. So
and that is the question, right? Is it possible to train or not train?
Yes. And that's the point. Can I train it away? Then I would say it's not a trauma. But it could be quite selective. The horse could be just fine. But when it is in the same situation, it could actually have some reactions that are not controllable, not treatable. And then I would say that's where trauma begins. Right? And the extreme trauma is the shutdown horse. And if you look at the stress hormones, they usually go, if you have a short lasting stress reaction, the catecholamines, mm-hmm. they're very high. And these are the hormones that mediate the fight flight response, extremely in horses, but also in us. Mm-hmm. But if you have chronic stress and it's long lasting, then the catecholamines, they take over. And in people with depression or with severe trauma, they actually don't have a lot of phenethylamine anymore because they had an extreme reaction, a glucocorticoid reaction, cortisol mm-hmm. reaction was extreme. And then the brain learns to suppress that reaction. And the glucocorticoids, the cortisol in humans, but also in horses, it destroys areas of the brain. And that is not, when it's extreme, it's not reversible. And that is why it's so difficult to help these people. And that is why it's so difficult to help these horses. There's no doubt that that is a trauma. But I think there's possibly an area in between. But I would say if you can't manage to have a successful treatment, you're probably starting to be in the realm of trauma.
Yeah. And when you are then talking about, or also think of another important tool that we have mentioned now many times during this conversation, is that when we are suspecting a horse to, or when we are having a horse with special effects, let's say it like this, we have a horse with special effects, it's always worth having a look at the 5-domain model.
Yes, absolutely.
And looking at everything around, because it might just be a horse that is telling us about its worries. It might just be a horse, and that we will see in 98% of all cases. It might just be a horse that has not given up on sending us messages and is trying to protect itself.
Yes, and I think if you have still a reactive horse, you're actually on the good side.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have, it's not good. I mean, it's dangerous, but you have a horse that's still reacting, which is not the case when a horse is shut down. Then it's really, really difficult to get a grip of the situation. So it's like you say, we still have a horse that tries to tell us something. And I really think it makes sense to work systematically through the 5-domains model, to start with the physical soundness, the lowest level, then to look at the group and at the social environment, to look, does it have enough turnout, to look, is there something with the feeding, and so on. So I think before we go into the realm of psychotherapy, which would be training a trauma away, we really should look, is there anything else that sort of keeps the stress level high? There might still be an issue and a fear issue that has been conditioned. But we have it so much more difficult if that comes with a full worry cup.
Yeah.
So if you manage to empty the worry cup and take all the other stresses away, we have a much better chance to treat the isolated problem.
And it is so often, you know, like a little bit like unpeeling the onion.
And exactly.
Just this morning, I had a student, and I know she had a question for you. So I'm waiting, Sersa, for your question here. She just got a new horse, and that is very interesting to train because he's doing 2 steps on the riding arena, freezing.
Ooh.
2 steps on the riding arena, freezing. So that in this severity, I have not seen in a very long time. And there we can talk minimum about a very severe stress response. And now we are starting to dig down. Where is it coming from? Is it the worry cup that is full because of something? Is that learned behavior? Is this trauma in some way? But he is responding on the very first lessons already so well that I don't believe it's trauma. It's a very, just a very stressed horse.
Yeah, it's probably new to him. I don't know, how long has he been there?
He has been there now since a few months, so she gave him good time to settle in did some health care stuff first before she thought now it's a good moment for starting to train, and was then herself also surprised because we also discovered that, of course, when she takes the horse to a lesson, also the human factor is not nothing, right? So she's a little bit stressed. The teacher is looking. You also would like to show your teacher that you have prepared the new horse well. And then you're going into this endless feedback loop in between horse and human that is, sometimes interesting.
Well, horses know exactly what kind of mood we are in. They can smell it. They can feel it. There are many studies showing that horses know exactly. They even look at our faces. They can even recognize faces of fear and when you smile or when you're good. So they're social animals, and they read each other from a long distance. And actually, the signals horses send are so much more subtle than what we do.
Absolutely,
so for them, we are probably so easy to read. Not talking about the smell,
but then in German we have this saying, the horse is your mirror. I also have a little bit stomach pain. I have a little bit stomach pain with that, because that is taking away the allowance for the horse to have its own issues. There you're back at the five domain model, right? So there you're putting everything onto just the horse-human relationship. I am also not there, but it's definitely a part of the story, I would say.
Yeah, I'm sure that, I mean, I have heard that before, and I think, I don't know, it's, I find it a complicated concept, because a horse may react differently. I mean, if you're stressed, mm-hmm. some horses may be stressed, and it's your mirror. But my Frau, for example, would say, you know what, just get your stuff together. I'm going here and eat. And when you're ready, you can come. So I think that's also a very inter-individual reaction to that. So, and then he's not mirroring me, because he's exactly doing that, what I'm not
doing. The opposite. Okay, now, I have Despino. He's just like, today he's 20. He says, don't worry, I carry you through. And then I have the youngsters who are saying, mommy is scared.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get scared together. But this is a different podcast, and this is a different topic. So I would say we wrap this up, and I say thank you for tonight. If there's no more questions, we are ending this here for tonight. And I will, for everybody who's interested in reading a little bit into Frauke's blog, we are putting that into our show notes. We are mentioning that in our show notes. And and then I would say thank you for tonight.
Thanks for having me, and it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun, as usual. Genau. Sometimes we take our coffee conversations live online, and otherwise we just do them in private, and I get a private lecture. Okay, thank you for tonight. Yes. Have a nice rest of the evening, and see you back very soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.